today we have the privilege of having Julie Lawrence talk about New Zealand emission reductions and global agreements, lessons from the past 20 years. Julie is one of the best placed people to discuss this matter. She has been involved in issues relating to climate change and environmental policy matters generally for a good part of her life. She has held senior positions within the New Zealand government, both as the chief executive of the Ministry of Women's Affairs and as the head of the climate change office and bit of the Ministry for the Environment. Has followed the matter very closely and is currently a senior research fellow part-time at the New Zealand Climate Change Research Institute at Victoria University. So, Judy, we look forward, well, some of us might look forward to what you have to say. Some of us might be rather concerned about what you have to say. But I'm sure it will be stimulating and we'll have an opportunity for discussion and debate after the presentation. Thanks, Judy.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And thank you all for coming out in the rain. It's not very nice out there. Now, I've had the privilege of having had a little bit of time with reflection since I worked in government about 6 years ago, which is a very good thing to have done. And today I'm going to look back over the last 20 years very quickly, sort of race through, because a lot has happened and a lot hasn't happened. And what I'm going to do is to first look at the international context within which New Zealand fits in the climate change area, how New Zealand has responded and how we've performed, and try and pull out some of the lessons from this. And probably more importantly, look at where we go from now and a way forward. Those who know me know that I am an optimist and I look forward, not backwards. So this is a somewhat unusual experience for me to be going back and looking at where we have been. Now, if we just quickly look at the climate change as a global issue and how long we've really known about this issue. During the 19th century, there were many, much discussion about climate change in its previous guises around the greenhouse effect way back in 1824, and then the link between the greenhouse effect and climate variation, and then finally the link between the global temperature and the increase in CO2 concentration, which occurred in 1896. Then there was a bit of a pause, and it wasn't really until the 1950s that the steady rise measured by Charles Keeling at Mauna Loa was publicised. And then not really until the 70s that the link of fossil fuel use was brought to public attention, first in the House of Representatives in the US on the potential consequences of unrestrained fossil fuel use, and then in 1977 the US National Academy of Sciences report, which some of us remember coming out, concluded that the industrial civilization may have to switch off fossil fuels. So that was during the 70s. Now, it was Schneider in 1976 that really put his finger on the nature of the issue. And I want to use part of this quote here, but what he was talking about was that we really don't have the luxury of actually having the evidence-based proof of climate change before we take action. And he said that we cannot afford to let the atmosphere carry out an experiment before taking action, and we should know one way or the other by the end of the century. Now that's the one we've just moved out of. By the end, if we do not take action, it will be too late to remedy the situation on account of the long residence time of CO2 in the atmosphere. Now, we've heard from Martin Manning and Peter Barrett and Andy Reisinger about this in previous lectures, so I won't go into those details. This was another 10 years before the IPCC was set up in 1988, after the Vila and Bellagio conferences, which some of you will be familiar with, started to get some real concern that there was a human connection with changes in climate, and more particularly changes in CO2 emissions and the impact that may have on the world. And it was 1990 when the first assessment report concluded the attribution was humans. The human-induced climate change is a real threat. And fairly quickly, the UNFCCC was adopted in 1992, and the Kyoto Protocol actually followed quite quickly afterwards for a global protocol on climate change. This was actually quite a stunning speed with which agreement was reached. However, as you know, it was not fully in force until 2005. Now, what are the guiding principles that have been driving the international response? And these are some of them. The precautionary principle, of course, was identified very early by Schneider and others in the 70s. And this is really what guided the first decade of climate change responses globally, that we really had to take some insurance policy here. We had to take some action that could give us some comfort in the future, that if we got things terribly wrong, then things got worse, we would have at least been able to take some actions which were less cost, no regrets, things that we could have done anyway that benefited society. So that was one of the driving principles. The common and differentiated responsibilities, the basis of that was really that the developed countries, like New Zealand and others, the big developed countries in particular, really have been the ones driving the climate change, and that the developed countries needed to take action prior to developing countries. And that was really what was behind the Kyoto Protocol, only covering developed countries. There was a general preference for market instruments throughout this period, and primarily a focus on mitigation. Adaptation really took a back seat until very recently, and country circumstances were what drove the agreements around Kyoto. And as most of you know, New Zealand's Kyoto commitment is different from Australia's, is different from the United States, is different from the Netherlands, for example. All the while this was going on during that decade, the science was getting more alarming. And the two critical things were that the human attribution was shown, and that warming was unequivocal was shown through the IPCC extensive peer-reviewed exercises. However, more recently, the likelihood of more than 2 degrees and the need to adapt to 4 degrees has become the likelihood. Ice sheets are losing mass, and in the last 2 or 3 years, the sea level rise estimates have doubled and are now in the vicinity of between 0.5 and 1.5 metres, and some say they could be up to an upper limit of 2 metres. And of course, there's some recent reports just come out today. The reports are from the Australian Climate Change, the EU, published reports by FEPA in Science, and Vermeer and Ramsdorff in geophysical research letters. And again today, the results coming out again from the Northern Hemisphere relating to Greenland. Now these are quite significant changes from what we have been planning for as a country, and also for what the world has been planning for, and they've come since the last IPCC report. Now in this context then, how does New Zealand fit as a nation at the negotiating table? We're a small emitter, we don't have much influence, and we have a lot to lose from what gets negotiated, which we as a good citizen country will sign up to and did sign up to. So we get out there and we are at the forefront of getting a comprehensive international agreement, one that covers removals by forests and by emission reductions. We seem to be doing our bit because we want to increase our trading partners, because we live in a world where we rely very much on our trade. So we really have a lot of choice. We have to be involved. Even though we're a small emitter and the public of New Zealand probably doesn't think that they have much influence and that we have very little, reducing emissions in New Zealand has very little influence. What have we done? We played a significant and influential role in the IPCC through being lead authors of a number of IPCC chapters and in various roles in the administration of the IPCC. We've been influential in negotiating carbon sinks in the UNFCCC and Kyoto. And Interestingly enough, very instrumental in developing the robust greenhouse gas accounting rules and the levy accounting practices that go with that. We currently chair one of the subsidiary bodies of the UNFCCC, so we play quite a significant role at that sort of level for New Zealand. However, we've had very small emission reduction offerings as a result. We've worked very fast on one side, but we have had very small emission reduction offerings to the trade. So how has New Zealand responded? This is just a very quick pocket history since 1988. Leaves out lots of things. The first decade really was a lot of talk. It was around targets, it was around lease costs, no regret policies, a lot of rhetoric, but very little substantive policy action. The most significant would have been the setting up of ECA and the ongoing struggle ECA had first to exist, to continue to exist, to be funded, to continue to be funded, and to their credit, they have introduced over time supportive policies that would support New Zealand's emission reductions at no or little cost. However, it's small offerings and small investment into one organisation to do that, a lot to expect ECA to achieve. Our target is to reduce emissions back to 1990 levels by 2012, or take responsibility for excess emissions. The second period was really a large discussion around carbon taxes. It took a long while to get there, a lot of work done on the ETS and carbon taxes during the 90s. The first comprehensive policy was issued in 2002 under the last Labor government. The carbon tax that would be recycled, the revenue would be recycled, some of it back into emission reduction activities. And a number of other support policies and legislation. It took quite a while to get implemented. Legislation was passed, quite significant legislation in fact, for local authorities to take their part in the adaptation side, and I'm not going to talk about that today, under the Resources Management Act particularly. The policies during this period were shown through a review that they had not enough impact. However, they made a start, an important start. However, that stopped. It was reviewed, and the result of that for the ETS was timelines under the previous government, which was introduced and passed into legislation. It also had a comprehensive support policy package around it, covering the usual suspects of energy efficiency, solar and insulation, transport fuels, etc., and also importantly regulations for appliances and legislation, some of which was introduced. However, in 2008 this was reviewed and the support policies were largely dismantled and are in the process of being replaced. Some are being replaced and they're in the process of being replaced, although we don't hear a lot about them at the moment. The new ETS and the timelines were extended, and you're aware of the debate around that in the last few weeks. What I want to just sort of look at for a minute are the barriers to action. First of all, during that first period of 88 to 98, and on the left there are the themes, what I would call the themes of the decade. In the early part of that decade, there was much scepticism around the science. There was a huge uncertainty about whether climate change was human-induced, and that's where most of the debate took place during that period. I remember many hours with Treasury talking through the issue, trying to describe that the issue was different from a normal environmental issue. It was one that we needed to plan for in decades, not in years, long-term issue. However, New Zealand was seen as a small contributor, and there was much scepticism during that period. Probably the overriding barrier during that period was the market will deliver, and a concern that To intervene was not going to actually deliver, and it would have unintended consequences, and it wouldn't get us to where we wanted to go. So the combination between that scepticism about the science and the market will deliver created a huge barrier to some of the discussions that went on in official circles. And I think testament is that the Retirement Effect policy issues were implemented during that period, other than the things I've mentioned already. There was deliberate sector obstruction, and this came in many forms. It came through non-transparent lobbying. It came through non-access of the wide sectors from NGOs to ministers and officials. During a period when delay was what was required, there was a general discussion around the sectors was that we can't take action because it's going to affect us, our costs, etc. Sounds familiar. So there was a decade of delay. As a result of that, there was no buy-in from politicians, except for a couple of ministers during that period who did work very hard, including Simon Upton, to broaden the debate and to get his colleagues online. And then in 1995, during the middle of this period, towards the end of the period, the balance of evidence suggested that there was a discernible human influence on global climate change. So one would expect then things to change. However, not so. Despite the science advancing, we had start, part implementation, stop review, start again. You get the picture. Consequences of this chopping and changing has meant that there's no certainty to the economy, emission reductions are unlikely, increases are likely to continue. There are weak signals currently encouraging, in the long term, relitigation and the potential for entitlements to be bedded in through legislation. When you write law that embeds a 1.3% reduction over a very long time, certain expectations are raised, and Jeff Bertram spoke about that the other week. There is discussion globally that embedding these sorts of allocation entitlements into law means that people down the track will potentially ask for compensation. This potentially makes it really difficult for a review to take place and for successive governments to actually change what has been agreed, unless something is written into the legislation to mitigate against entitlements. However, in my experience with environmental law, I would suggest it's better not to write the law in a way that does that in the first place, rather than to try and write it out of the law after it's in the law. However, it will also create an ability to gear up quickly. It would be very poor in enabling that to happen down the track as a consequence. And also, probably most importantly, the weak near-term policy means that costs are pushed out into the future. Now I'll come back to that point because it has quite an impact on the way in which we do our analysis in the future and where one of the forward-looking ideas comes from. So how are we performed? I think you know most of this. New Zealand's emissions are 22% higher than 1990 levels and are tracking to be 30% higher by 2012. So we've got a bit of a big ask out there. The government's long-term targets of 450 ppm is not equivalent to limiting warming to 2 degrees. It's likely 50% chance of it going over that. The domestic target to 2050, 50% below 1990 levels, is totally inconsistent with the IPCC's findings in 2007. And bearing in mind the point Rafe made very clearly in his presentation a while back, those 2007 findings are based on research that was carried out probably 3 years before, 5 years before. So we're really in catch-up mode. The goals are effectively not matched by the policy. And curiously, it's very unclear what the plan is to achieve these weak goals. There's our emissions. I won't go into the details here, but I will just pause on this one. This is where the increases, this is 2006 figures, by the way, not the 2007, but they're not that different. It's the point that I want to make. forget about the height of the bars, but look at the figures. And these are this is what I call the low-hanging fruit. Road transportation, electricity generation, and heat production, in particular, is where we have quite large potential to reduce our emissions, and where effective policies are really long overdue to ensure that that can happen. Agricultural soils is another I'd like to just mention. We understand from the science that there's probably a 20% potential through farm management practices alone, and I'm not just talking about fertiliser application, to reduce agricultural soil emissions through that nitrous oxide. Animals in the winter part of the soil creates an environment where you get greater, you know, N2O emissions. Use of standoff pads and a number of other practices on the farm, the way in which the mob stocking is carried out, for those of you who are familiar with farming practices, all of those things can make a difference to the emissions of nitrous oxide. And so there is potential now for reduced emissions to occur. So why haven't we been reducing them? These are the sorts of things that other countries' policies have done to reduce their emissions. And I think the interesting point is that they are comprehensive and consistent in comparison to ours. Probably not totally consistent, but they're more consistent than ours. They have comprehensive packages of policies and targets. They have economic instruments and regulatory framework which are aligned and made to complement each other. They have independent advisors and peer reviewers. And importantly, they've used markets and regulations to actively address transport emissions through car size and efficiency of motors and vehicles, public transport, and also their energy use through pricing and low carbon alternatives have been actively regulated in a lot of European countries, particularly. So why are we not reducing emissions? Yes, I see the So why are we different? We are different in some respects because of our emissions profile and because we rely on our agricultural exports. But as I said earlier, we need to be at the table to ensure a comprehensive international agreement is in our interest to protect our export and tourist sectors, and we need to reduce our emissions locally to protect our reputation, our 100% pure, and to counter trade barriers. And so for those who say, well, we can get out of Kyoto, it really isn't an option. It isn't an option because the rest of the world will go ahead and draw up probably more severe international agreements, which could have a significant impact on our country. So we need to be there and we need to be able to influence. And we have low carbon choices now, but these have been slow through lack of incentives. So why is this uptake slow in New Zealand? As a nation, we haven't been convinced that action in New Zealand is necessary. Individually, we might think it is, but as a nation, we haven't been. And so our politicians reflect that. It requires, in some cases, capital to invest. Programs have been set up to provide incentives, financial grants and incentives for capital to invest, both in small business and in households. However, it's still small bickies. We have a tendency as humans to avoid costs now, and we value what we have, and we see change as a loss. And I want to just run through quickly some thoughts about the way in which climate change policy has been framed in terms of costs. We've often thought of it as a tax or a cost of the ETS. So I just want to talk about framing for a minute. I think he's confused. Framing matters. Economic modelling of climate change impacts in New Zealand has shown lower but still positive rates of economic growth relative to business as usual. From those figures were in the Infometrics NZIAR report to the Ministry of the Environment in May 2009. But this gets reported as something else. It gets reported as a cost of reducing emissions. However, this miscommunicates the impact by implying a lowering of living standards relative to current levels now, which is untrue. and it would be there framed as income in 2025 being $54,000 per capita instead of $56,000 per capita without policy. Now this graph indicates what I'm talking about. The top line is with no mitigation and the bottom line is with mitigation. And the difference between the two is approximately 1.5 years. This is using the $100 a tonne carbon figure that was on that last slide. So effectively what this means is that the growth that we would have otherwise had is just delayed slightly. So it's not a cost. It's not a cost on us in today's terms. Now, research that was done for MFE in 2006 by Steve Hatfield, Dodds and Nigel Jollins is very interesting. And it shows that people are much more willing to sacrifice some future improvement in living standards than a reduction in current living standards. So that would sort of give you a bit of a clue as to how one might present this sort of information to the general public. And in this case, the difference in percentages is shown in the next bullet point. 57% of New Zealand respondents supported action with cost framing, while 73% supported it when it was communicated incomes were going to rise, but less than without policy action. So the conclusion they came to was that the effect of existing communication bias is large enough to constrain policy formulation, preventing or delaying the development of policies that would attract widespread public support if communicated appropriately. And I think this is a very interesting lesson from this particular piece of research. Now this is also consistent with research carried out in the States at Columbia University, which shows that for climate change information to be fully absorbed by audiences, it must be actively communicated along these lines. Appropriate language, combined with narrative storytelling, made vivid through visual imagery and experiential scenarios, balanced with scientific information and delivered with trusted messengers in group settings. So there's some interesting information available for the communication of climate change. And here's just one suggestion for an experiential learning situation. So why aren't we making progress? There are a number of political factors that are affecting them. The framing often reflects the flavour of the government in power rather than what we know about framing. The three-year election cycle leads to rushed policy and changes to any previous government policy. And a testament to this was the reassessment of policy twice recently due to so-called lack of electoral support or to coalition deals under MMP to get something through. So not broad electoral support, I don't think. And I think we have to say that some groups, and largely big emitters, have influenced ministers disproportionately due to their immediate cost concerns, miscommunication, and I would say mischief. I see Simon Upton had strong words in the paper yesterday. The policy process. The policy proposals and negotiated deals proceed really quickly, very often very quickly, and therefore without adequate analysis at the wire as a result of political rush. The second point is something that I think we need to dwell on quite a lot in New Zealand, because most of the economic analysis has been based on static situation rather than the dynamic situation that we are in, and also it largely excludes technological changes. So we have only about part of the picture through the economic analyses that have been carried out to date. We probably have inadequate institutional arrangements for policy development on an issue like climate change, and the constant change in arrangement doesn't help, because we get a churn of people with a, if anyone knows about how groups form, they norm and storm and then they become effective. So the moment you change institutions and change the people in them, the whole process of learning that has to continue. And it is helped by people who can stay there for a long time and contribute to the analysis, but it is difficult. And the question is around whether the right questions are being asked. And by that I mean, I go back to this question about economic analysis. Are we really thinking of the long term, or are we always looking at snapshots of time which go out, say, 5 years, in another 5 years, rather than looking at the long term? and developing tools that can enable us to consider the long term through our analyses. So the critical missing elements occur to me to be interdisciplinary socioeconomic modelling capacity to test impact of policy with respect to our New Zealand interests. Thank you very much. And I say socioeconomic because I think the issues of psychology are extremely important in terms of how people receive information, how they understand information, and the things that trigger them to take action. Research shows that individuals are more influenced by whether their neighbour is putting in their double glazing or their solar panels than they are about any promotion by governments, for example. So I think we need to understand that more, and we need to factor that into our analysis. The second point is a very important point and a very difficult one to marry against the political pressures. Having transparent dialogue and engagement that builds trust. We have set up mechanisms to do this, like the leadership forum that was set up in the, by the last government to shepherd through and discuss the ETS. However, it's been disestablished. And I have on good authority that people out in the regions are missing that. Local government enjoyed having that round the table discussion with big industry, small industry, and people in Wellington, because it enabled them to better understand how they can take action locally. And they're not now in the loop, they're out of the loop. And given the role that local government plays in infrastructure, for example, and planning that can have an influence on urban design and so forth, I would suggest it's very important that local government are at the table and considered very seriously in this. We have poor independent review of our policy analysis, and I would suggest that an element missing is that we should be set up to be comparable with our IPCC process for science. I mean, why would we do it for science and not do it for policy? It doesn't make sense if we're going to have some robust understanding and policies which are effective at central government and local government. And we need to put more effort into the mechanisms for transferring information to rural land users. We have this so-called divide between rural and urban. I'm not convinced personally that it's as great as it is made out to be. However, we need to be talking to each other and need to be having a dialogue.